Welcome to Making Waves, independent voices for peace and justice on WSCA 106.1 LPFM in Portsmouth, New Hampshire. Today, March 19th, 2005, marks 2 years since the U.S. invaded Iraq. In view of this, we are focusing on Iraq and the Middle East today. In the first hour, we will hear a talk by Naomi Klein on Iraq and the recent elections there. In the second hour, we will have announcements, music, and an interview with activist Bobby Luton about her work around the occupation in Palestine. First, we bring you Jeff White with some news.
Good afternoon, and welcome to some news on Making Waves. The withdrawal of more than a dozen countries over the last year could complicate efforts to keep the peace while Iraq's new government builds up police and military units capable of taking over from foreign forces. 2 years after the U.S.-led invasion toppled Saddam Hussein, the coalition is unraveling amid mounting casualties and kidnappings that have stoked anti-war sentiment and have sapped leaders' resolve to keep troops in harm's way. 38 countries have provided troops in Iraq at one point or another, but 14 nations have permanently withdrawn since March 2003, and today's coalition stands at 24, excluding U.S. forces. There are 22,750 foreign soldiers still in Iraq. About 150,000 U.S. troops shoulder the bulk of the responsibility and suffer the most casualties. Among the countries that have recently withdrawn are the Ukraine, Netherlands, and Poland. Among the nations that withdrew last year were Spain, which pulled out 1,300 soldiers, Tonga, New Zealand, Thailand, the Philippines, Honduras, the Dominican Republic, Nicaragua, and Hungary. Norway withdrew 150 troops but left 16 liaison officers. And Singapore withdrew their 160 as well. Last month, Portugal withdrew 127 soldiers, and Moldova pulled out 12. Ferocious insurgent attacks, coalition casualties, and a spate of civilian abductions and beheadings have rattled ordinary citizens in many countries. This story from the Progressive Newswire. The Center for Constitutional Rights and partnering law firms today filed a federal lawsuit against Illinois-based Caterpillar Incorporated on behalf of the parents of Rachel Corey, the 23-year-old American peace activist and student who was run over and killed by a Caterpillar D9 bulldozer on March 16, 2003. The suit alleges that Caterpillar violated international and state law by providing specially designed bulldozers to Israeli defense forces that it knew would be used to demolish homes and endanger civilians. The Corey's daughter, Rachel, a student at Evergreen State College in Olympia, Washington, was there as a volunteer peace activist protesting the demolition of Palestinian homes when she was brutally killed. Much of the world community, including international human rights organizations and the United Nations, has consistently condemned these demolitions as a clear violation of international humanitarian law. Jenny Green, senior attorney with the Center for Constitutional Rights, stated, "International law clearly provides that corporations can be held accountable for violations of international human rights. Over the past 4 years, the Israeli Defense Force has used Caterpillar bulldozers to destroy more than 4,000 Palestinian homes, injuring, killing, or leaving homeless scores of individuals in the process. Rights groups have sent over 50,000 letters to Caterpillar Incorporated executives and CEO Jim Owens decrying the use of Caterpillar bulldozers to carry out human rights abuses." And this from the Vermont Guardian. "Israelis' occupation of the Palestinian territories is taking a high toll, not just on Palestinians, but on Israelis' society and economy as well, according to a report released this month by Oxfam. More than one-third of Israel's population is surviving in tough economic conditions and has little chance to invest in the future," the report found. "Military spending, the cost of Jewish settlements in Palestine, and the Intifada's impact on tourism have increased poverty and sharply eroded the strength of the Israeli economy," according to a report. "The poorest and most vulnerable sections of Israeli society are suffering serious consequences from the government's prioritization of national security over social welfare," according to the Oxfam report. 34% of the population is now defined as poor, Oxfam notes, and there has been an increase in soup kitchens and food pantries to feed the Israeli poor. All Israeli families suffered a 15% cut in child support benefits, directly affecting 2.1 million children, the report found. And this from the Associated Press. The U.S. Army has asked Congress to allow it to extend enlistment contracts offered to future soldiers by 2 years from 6 to 8 years in order to stabilize the force, as top defense officials warned that key recruitment targets for the year could be missed. The appeal coincided with the release of a new congressional report that showed that the intensifying anti-American insurgency in Iraq and continued violence in Afghanistan were followed by a distinct drop in the number of volunteers willing to serve in the branches of the military that see the most combat. The Army Reserve and Army National Guard respectively met only 87% and 80% of their overall recruiting goals in the first quarter of fiscal 2005. The shortfalls could potentially have a noticeable effect on units operating in Iraq, Afghanistan, and surrounding areas because, according to defense officials, reservists and guardsmen make up about 46% of the total force deployed there. And this from Reuters. President George Bush's nomination of Paul Wolfowitz as head of the World Bank has triggered reactions of outright hostility from many foreign governments and aid groups. Some believe he is unqualified for the job, while others fear he will be all too effective in using the post to expand America's global dominance. Although his nomination is almost certain to be accepted by the World Bank's board of directors and participating states, both the European Union and the French government made a point of saying that this assumption of his presidency is not a foregone conclusion. Clear short, the former International Development Secretary described the nomination of the Bush administration's leading neoconservative hawk as the equivalent of sticking up two fingers to the world. This is really shocking. It's as though they are trying to wreck our international systems. Caroline Lucas, a British Green and member of the European Parliament, described the nomination as an insult to the world's poor. As a leader of the neoconservative movement, she added, Wolfowitz's belief in unfettered free markets and a philosophy that what is in the U.S.'s interest is hereby in the interest of the entire world spells disaster for many countries in the developing world. Many experts and government officials found it troubling that the Bush administration, in nominating someone for a job dependent on consensus building, would pick someone who has become a symbol of U.S. resistance to that very consensus. Not only did Mr. Wolfowitz push harder than anyone for the invasion of Iraq 2 years ago, with or without the approval of the rest of the world, he also has a long track record of advocacy of a strong America acting as it sees fit, preemptively if necessary, to protect its global interest. He has since admitted in an interview that the basis for the war in Iraq was access to Iraqi oil. This appointment signals to developing countries that the U.S. is just as serious about imposing its will on borrowers from the World Bank as on countries of the Middle East, said the director from the U.S.-based 50 Years is Enough Network, an outspoken critic of the World Bank. This story also from the Vermont Guardian. The federal government will force states to pick up an extra $30 billion in expenses in fiscal 2006, mostly for education programs that Congress passed without providing enough resources to pay for them. The National Council complained in its March 8th report that the problem of unfunded mandates, programs required by Washington but not fully funded, is a long-term burden made only worse by President Bush's most recent budget proposals. Over the coming decades, states would have to pick up at least $300 billion in costs for federal programs. Nearly two-thirds of the additional costs to states would be in the area of K-12 education. More than $18 billion will be from funding gaps in two federal education programs, Bush's signature No Child Left Behind Act and Individuals with Disabilities Education Act. States face other unfunded mandates, according to the group, reflected in Bush's proposed 2006 budget. And this from the Associated Press. This week, the Senate, by a very narrow margin, decided to give oil companies access to an ecologically rich Alaskan wildlife refuge. President Eisenhower placed the 1.5 million acres of coastal plain, known as the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, under federal protection in 1960. During several hours of debate last week, supporters of drilling the refuge in the northeastern corner of Alaska argued that access to the oil was a matter of national security and that modern drilling technology would protect the region's wildlife. Environmentalists contended that while new technologies have reduced the drilling footprint, the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge's coastal plain still would contain a spiderweb of pipelines that would disrupt calving caribou and disturb polar bears, musk oxen, and the annual influx of millions of migratory birds. Senator Richard Durbin, Democrat of Illinois, said even at peak production, the refuge would account for less than 2.5% of U.S. oil needs. How in the world can this be the centerpiece of our energy policy, asked Durbin, arguing that more conservation and more fuel-efficient automobiles would save more oil than the Alaska refuge would ever produce. Drilling proponents acknowledge that even if Congress gives the go-ahead for tapping of the oil, it would have no impact on soaring oil prices and tight supplies. The first lease sales would not be issued until 2007, followed by development 7 to 10 years later. President Bush has made access to the refuge's oil a key part of his energy agenda. Last week, Bush declared that 10 billion barrels of oil are waiting to be pumped from the refuge and that could be tapped with almost no impact on land or wildlife, or how about the people that live there. However, how much oil will be found is in dispute. Only one exploratory well has been drilled within the refuge, and the results have been kept secret. And that's the news.
On February 16, 2005, at UC Santa Cruz, Naomi Klein presented her talk, War and Fleece, Economic Shock Therapy in Iraq, in which she also shared her analysis of the January 30th Iraq election. Here now is Naomi Klein.
I'm sure all of you watched the news on January 30th and saw the incredible images out of Iraq, lineups of women in veils waiting in the face of tremendous violence to cast their ballots, and those amazing images of the purple fingers holding up their fingers and smiling. And you can't fake joy like that. That was real joy. But I wasn't sure that I shared the analysis of the pundits on Fox News and CNN about what Iraqis were actually saying with their purple fingers and their smiles and their dances. And I was watching this self-congratulatory coverage, and my mind turned to my late grandmother. I have this very vivid memory. I think I was about 10, and I was spying on a conversation between my father and my grandmother, where he was trying to convince my grandmother to give up her driver's license because she was an absolute menace behind the wheel. At this point, she was half blind and, frankly, in the early stages of Alzheimer's, but she would not give up her driver's license. And we all knew that she was a holy terror and that she was, you know, flattening house pets and mailboxes everywhere she went. But she had a certain routine in Philadelphia, so she would sort of go, you know, where she went, and she kind of knew the way, and she could sort of get away with the fact that she couldn't really see. So she was saying to my father, she goes, "No, people are so friendly. Everywhere I drive, they're always waving at me." And I just remember listening to this conversation, and my father goes, "Jean, are you sure they're waving with their whole hand?" And then he gave my grandmother the finger, which is what really left an impression on me as a 10-year-old. And I thought about that as I was reading this column by a woman named Betsy Hart, who writes a syndicated column for Scripps Howard News Service. She described the Iraqi elections. She said, "The Iraqi people gave America the biggest thank you in the best way we could have hoped for." And I kept thinking, Betsy, are you sure they're waving with their whole hand? I don't think they were waving with their whole hand. I think they were only using one finger. The election results, as we know, have come in. And here's what we know about the results of those elections. The candidates who were clearly associated with the United States and seen clearly as their surrogates, Iyad Alawi, for one, another White House favorite who was the guest during last year's State of the Union address, Adnan Pataci, they were both roundly defeated at the polls. 51% of Iraqis cast their ballots for a coalition, people are calling it the Shia coalition, that's backed by Grand Ayatollah Ali al-Sistani. The coalition is the United Iraqi Alliance. 51% of voters voted for the United Iraqi Alliance. And the central part of their platform, circulated all over Iraq in all the newspapers, was calling for a timetable for the withdrawal of multinational forces from Iraq. This was central to their platform. So in other words, Iraqis were not voting to thank President Bush, as one would have thought from watching CNN or Fox, even worse. It wasn't a thank you for invading us. They were voting for them to leave Iraq, very clearly. They were not waving with their whole hands. Another 25% of people who went out and voted for separatist Kurdish parties. They don't mind if the U.S. stays in Iraq. They want to leave Iraq, okay? So when you have that level of a desire for separation from the country of Iraq, it is hardly an endorsement of the status quo. Then you have all the Iraqis who didn't vote. The Sunnis, who make up roughly 20% of the population, barely voted. Anbar province, where Fallujah is located, had participation rate of 2%. Some of this was practical. In Fallujah, for instance, most residents hadn't even returned to the city. I think there are only 7,000 people who've moved back to Fallujah. At the same time, Fallujans were prevented from voting in Baghdad. And it's interesting because when Fallujah was invaded again, was bombed, was leveled 4 days after the U.S. elections, it was bombed in the name of democracy. We were told they were going to bring freedom and democracy to the people of Fallujah. Well, they couldn't vote. But many people could vote but chose not to. They actively boycotted the elections. They followed the advice of the most influential Sunni organization, which is the Association of Muslim Scholars. The Association of Muslim Scholars is not against elections. Their position is they would not have elections under occupation. And they said that the U.S. had to withdraw to bases, they had to bring the U.N. in to administer the elections, and there had to be a timetable for withdrawal. Because what they were concerned about was that the elections were being used as public relations, and they wanted a guarantee that the elections would not be used, as they have been used, to legitimize the occupation. So they were not against democracy, as we've been told. They were for another version of democracy, and these were their conditions, which were, of course, completely ignored. You have 51% of the population that votes for a party promising to ask the U.S. to leave explicitly. And then you have another 15 to 20% that boycotts the elections because they're so adamant that the U.S. must withdraw that they won't even participate. Then you have the followers, for instance, of Muqtada al-Sadr, who's Shia. He's a young cleric, the radical cleric. I'm sure you've heard about him. He's one of the new boogeymen. Sadr has a huge base in Iraq, and his position was basically the same as the Association of Muslim Scholars, that it was an illegitimate process because it was being controlled by the occupiers, that the U.S. was not an impartial force in Iraq, so therefore they could not be impartial administrators of the election because the U.S. has very clear positions on the outcome it would like to see. It's no secret that Washington wants permanent military bases in Iraq, for instance. So on the central question for Iraqis of whether they're going to stay or whether they're going to leave, they have a clear point of view. So Sadr's position was these particular elections are illegitimate, clearly a position for withdrawal, so you have even more Iraqis who didn't participate who support withdrawal, which is simply to say that a clear majority of Iraqis want American troops to leave. So what was the response to this wonderful exercise in democracy? It was from George Bush to say that the elections made him incredibly proud of the Iraqi people, that it was a day for freedom, a triumph over terror, and he said, you don't set timetables for withdrawal. And so did Condi, and so did Rumsfeld, and so did Cheney. They all went out immediately after the elections and said, there will be no timetable. We will not do the one thing you have just asked us to do. Prime Minister Tony Blair said that the elections were magnificent. Magnificent was his word. And there will be no timetable for withdrawal. So sort of elections as a kind of performance. You know, we applaud them. Wonderful on you. You are so courageous to have voted, and now we will completely disregard what you have done, what you have asked us for. Because we were told, and we were told this quite seriously, by many commentators in the States, that it actually didn't matter who Iraqis voted for. What mattered was the fact of their voting, Geraldo Rivera, for instance, was so moved by this that he cried. He cried on television. He said, I felt like such a sap. Laura Bush, she was like a proud mother, you know, as if she'd just given birth to Iraq's democracy. She said, it was so moving for the president and me to watch the people come out with their purple fingers. So this is what democracy has come to in Iraq. The point of the elections is not to set policy or even to earn the right of self-government. The point, we were told, was twofold. The point, number one, was for Iraqis to prove to Americans that they wanted to be free. The second point was to stand up to terror and vote anyway. After the elections, George Bush announced that the meaning of these elections was that there was now proof, quote, that the Iraqi people value their liberty. Now, stunningly, to me anyway, this appears to come as news to many, many Americans who seem to be under the impression that Iraqis enjoyed being oppressed. They liked it. There was also a wave of people who had been against the occupation, against the war, who suddenly changed their mind after the elections. And one of them was this guy, Mark Brown, who's now the toast of the Republican blog scene. He writes for the Chicago Sun-Times, and he wrote one of these mea culpa columns. He said originally he opposed the war, but now he supports it because, he said, the elections were the first clear sign that freedom may really mean something to the people of Iraq. The first clear sign. My favorite was actually this incredible exchange on The Daily Show between Anderson Cooper and Jon Stewart. Anderson Cooper was beside himself. He said a lot of really crazy things that night. One of them was, he said something changed in Iraq that day. Even the bombs sounded different. Even the bombs sounded different. But then at the end of the interview, Jon Stewart goes, so are you going back? And he goes, are you crazy? I'm not going back there. So I guess the bombs didn't sound that different. Anderson Cooper said that the elections, and this is a quote, were the first time we've sort of had a gauge of whether or not the Iraqis are willing to sort of step forward and do stuff. I mean, they really haven't been asked to do anything so far. This was the first time Anderson Cooper, who's been to Iraq a couple of times, noticed that Iraqis are willing to do stuff to be free. He didn't notice it in 1991, for instance, when at the end of the first Gulf War, when George Bush Sr. urged the Iraqi people to rise up and overthrow their dictator. Tens of thousands of Shias did exactly that. And they waited for the backup, and it never arrived, and they were left to be slaughtered. They thought the U.S. would back them up, but they were wrong. And it's their bodies that are being uncovered in mass graves around Iraq. They were willing to do stuff to be free, and it was the U.S. government that was not willing to back them up. In the months after the invasion, this 2003 invasion, Iraqis proved once again that they were willing to do all kinds of stuff to build the democracy that they had been promised. In the summer of 2003, the summer after the invasion, Baghdad fell in April. That summer, there was an amazing renaissance of democracy in Iraq. There were hundreds of newspapers that cropped up. Independent Arabic news agencies were being set up. There was a really incredible movement of independent Arabic journalism. Stations like Al Arabiya, Al Jazeera, reporting in Iraq, doing incredible coverage. The other thing people wanted is elections, and they started to organize them without any permission in the cities, in towns. They just realized, you know, they need to get organized. They don't have water, they don't have electricity, they've got to get organized. And so they voted for local councils all over the country. Even in Mosul, which is the third largest city in Iraq, they held elections in May, right after the... They didn't wait. They didn't wait for anybody to tell them to do it. They just held elections. They couldn't wait to have democracy. We hear discussions sometimes about whether Iraqis are ready for democracy. And there was a quote in The Independent from someone who said, I've been ready for 35 years. We're ready for democracy. At the first meeting of the Baghdad City Council, the very first item on the agenda was, let's have a census. Let's have a census so that we're ready for elections. That was the first item on the agenda. People voted for it unanimously. They were ready for elections. This was the summer after the invasion. You guys probably remember Paul Bremer, who was the sort of U.S.-appointed governor of Iraq. In fact, Lakhdar Brahimi, who was the U.N. envoy to Iraq, at one point was giving a radio interview, and he called Bremer the dictator of Iraq because he had absolute power to make laws in that country. But there was somebody who preceded Bremer who, at the very start of the occupation, who was Jay Garner, a retired general. And Jay Garner announced very shortly after his arrival that the occupation would be extremely short-lived. He said that he was going to transfer authority, civilian authority, to a provisional Iraqi government that would be chosen, that would be elected in a national assembly. And he said that that would happen within weeks, okay? Then would come preparations for national elections. This was the original plan. This was Plan A. I think we might be at Plan H by now. So Plan A was they were immediately going into preparations for national elections, and they would hand over power directly from the occupation authority to an elected government. That was the original plan, and it's really important to understand that. Kofi Annan, in July, gave an address to the UN Security Council, and he said, it's time to start registering voters immediately, so we're ready for elections. Even Donald Rumsfeld predicted that the occupation would last for months, not for years, as it did. And he said that they would hand over power to an elected government, that Iraqis would choose their next government. That is what was said by the UN, by Donald Rumsfeld, by Jay Garner. That's what Iraqis believed. That's what they were promised. What they were promised was that these were liberators, that they were going to choose their next government, they were going to have national elections. Suddenly, there was a change in plan. And that change in plan coincided with the arrival of Paul Bremer, Jay Garner's replacement. He had a different vision for Iraq. It was a vision that, as we'll see as we talk more, was fundamentally incompatible with democracy. Jay Garner is a pragmatist. And there was a sort of a battle within the White House between the pragmatists, who are sort of old school colonialist, quick and dirty, you know, let's just go in there, we'll get our military bases, we'll try to secure the oil, we'll get out. We don't want to be in here making, you know, minute decisions. We want to leave that to the Iraqis. He has said this openly. That was his vision. But then there is this other group within the White House who are sometimes called the neocons. I like this phrase that the historian De La Pirro uses. He calls them the year zeroists. The year zeroists, because they're much more ambitious than the pragmatists. They don't want to just kind of tinker with Iraq, have a few bases, get economic control over the oil. They wanted to start over. Year one, new country, blank slate. I've come to think of it that maybe it's not a coincidence that the 2 years of Iraq's occupation were also the years where the extreme makeover was going really crazy on American television. And I imagine sort of, you know, Americans sitting at home flipping with their converter between, you know, extreme makeovers with plastic surgery and extreme weight loss and Queer Eye for the Straight Guy and the whole narrative of the extreme makeover, you know, bulldozing houses, starting over from scratch. The narrative of the extreme makeover is sort of like the American dream gone nuts, right? It's total reinvention, right? But if you think about what is the narrative of the extreme makeover, the narrative is, everything you are currently sucks. We're starting over from scratch. The worse you are, the better it is, the better a story it is. Like, the fatter you are, the more fun it'll be to see you lose weight. The uglier you are, the more fun it'll be to see how much surgery you can possibly have, right? So if you think about, like, the, you know, Queer Eye for the Straight Guy, it's just like, all of your stuff sucks. We're throwing everything out, okay? What do you have to do? Nothing. Nothing. Just sit back and leave it to the experts, okay? Because we are the professionals and we understand about style, design, shopping, architecture. Leave it to us. You are a passive person here. Your one goal is to look in the mirror at the end of it and gasp with joy and pleasure, okay? That's the extreme makeover. That, in essence, and I'm not kidding here, was Paul Bremer's plan for Iraq. Year zero. Let's start over, okay? They went in there, and the reason, you know, if we think back to those early days when Iraq was being looted and its cultural history was being destroyed, and this, the cradle of civilization was just being ravaged, and Donald Rumsfeld had a press conference, and he was asked about the looting of Iraq's museums and libraries, and he said, stuff happens. Stuff happens. You know what? If you're doing an extreme makeover, you're starting from scratch, everything's got to go. Everything's got to go. That's why they didn't mind. That's why they didn't even really try to stop the looting. I'm convinced of it. Iraq was being reborn. They just needed this single nucleus of cells for the new country. That's the oil ministry, which they protected. The one thing they protected. Paul Bremer had never been to Iraq before, but on his second day, he gave an interview and announced that Iraq's entire economy was backwards. He called it Stalinist socialist dogma. Everything must go. He arrived in May. In June, he went to a conference and announced he was selling all 200 of Iraq's state companies. It's all got to go. Backwards, relics of another era. It was going to be a brand new modern country. Everywhere he looked, he saw a market. He liked the religious sites. He said they could be great tourist attractions. This is true. He said it to Frontline. Then he proceeded to tear up Iraq's constitution and write a new one. He issued 100 orders, 100 laws during his time as viceroy. The Economist magazine called it the wish list for foreign investors. These were a few of his rules. Foreign companies can come to Iraq and own 100% of Iraqi assets. They can own the assets, and then they can make money, and they can take 100% of their profits out of the country. They can sign leases that will last for 40 years and then be renewed. All of this under occupation. Foreign banks, which had previously been banned, were allowed in. They issued licenses to HSBC, Barclays. At the time, I would go to these trade shows, Rebuilding Iraq, and it was like people hadn't been this excited since the dot-com crash, right? It was like free money. And there was all this talk of there's going to be a McDonald's in downtown Baghdad. There's going to be a Walmart that's going to just, you know, what do you need state companies for? There's going to be a Walmart. The Iraqis are going to be so excited. They're not going to know what hit them. The other thing Paul Bremer did as soon as he arrived is he laid off 500,000 people. 400 of them were soldiers. All of them gone. We'll start over, right? And they've been trying to rebuild Iraq's army ever since. Let's start from scratch. Now, interestingly, when you read the interviews with these guys, with Paul Bremer, and he had two deputies. One of them's name was Thomas Foley, never been to Iraq. In fact, he never had a diplomatic post. He was in charge of private sector development. What he was a Bush campaign pioneer and a corporate turnaround specialist. He buys up companies and turns them around, sells them for more money. And he said, look, Iraq is the mother of all turnarounds. So he thought he was qualified for the job. The other deputy was Michael Fleischer, Ari's brother. There was a meeting that Michael Fleischer held with a group of Iraqi businessmen who were terrified that they were going to be driven out of business by all of these foreign companies that were supposedly coming. Now, this is a country that has gone through three wars and has just come out of 12 years of brutal economic sanctions, and the lights are still out. Paul Bremer announces Iraq is open for business, completely wide open to any foreign exports, just flooded the market, no tariffs, no taxes. The other one of Bremer's orders is he brought in a 15% flat tax. Now, as many of you know, Republicans in this country, they dream of a 15% flat tax. It's one of their obsessions, right? It's one of the only things they actually haven't done yet is bring in a flat tax to this country. Businesses in Iraq, they used to have to pay taxes at a rate of 40%, but now they all pay a flat tax of 15%. So Michael Fleischer, Ari's brother, Ari Fleischer used to be the press secretary for the White House, so his brother was the press secretary during the invasion, and then he was in charge of selling off Iraq's assets. Anyway, Michael Fleischer has this meeting, and the Iraqi business people are upset, angry. They say, how are we supposed to compete? You know, we don't have spare parts. We don't have electricity. And Michael Fleischer says to them, he sounds like the guy on Survivor. He goes, only the best of you will survive. You will be voted off of your country. And then he says, you know, you guys are lucky. The entire Republican Party is envious of your tax law. And I mean, I spoke to a lot of Iraqi business people when I was there. They were like, we don't want to be their experiment. No, we don't. We just want to have a regular country. These are guys who are in favor of the free market. They just don't want to be anyone's utopian capitalism. Now, the end of this, of course, was the moment where Iraqis were supposed to look in the mirror and gasp with pleasure at their new modernization. But What I was going to say before I went off on that Michael Fleischer anecdote is that neither Foley or Fleischer or Bremer, they never would admit that what they were doing was governing Iraq. Because, of course, Iraq was being invaded in the name of democracy, so there was a fundamental conflict with the fact that these occupiers were writing all of these laws, locking them in, selling off the country. But they would refuse to admit that what they were doing was governing Iraq. They kept calling it modernizing. They kept calling it governance instead of government. They had all of these sort of, you know, what they were doing was they were bringing best practices to Iraq. They used all of this sort of technical language. And Thomas Foley, Mr. Corporate Turnaround Specialist, said, you know, I don't understand what the big deal is. It was really a gift to the Iraqi people, what we were doing. And of course, they were supposed to receive it as a gift, but they didn't. They received it as if they had just lost their jobs, as if 500,000 people had just lost their jobs in a country where the unemployment rate was at 67%. They received it as if their country was being sold off and transformed by foreigners, which of course it was. And they began to resist. They did a poll in Iraq about attitudes towards the public sector. And the results of this poll were extremely alarming to the denizens of the Green Zone. Because what they found in this poll, they asked, what type of political party would you vote for in an election? And more than half of the respondents said that they would vote for a political party that promised to create jobs in the public sector. And 5% said they would vote for a political party that promised to create jobs in the private sector, because they didn't believe that it actually would, because what they've seen of the private sector was Bechtel, Halliburton, all of these American companies coming in, bringing their own workers from abroad, and they associated them with mass unemployment. So this was their crash course in the free market, and they didn't much like it. So democracy, which had sounded like a very good idea before the invasion, when everything was just on paper, started to look like a very dangerous idea indeed to the Bush administration. Because it became clear that Iraqis were not going to accept their shiny new privatized country like a delighted contestant on a reality TV show. The free people of Iraq were resisting the free markets that they were trying to impose. That's when those elections suddenly seemed like a very bad idea. So one of Bremer's first acts as envoy was to start to backpedal on all those promises that I just described, that Jay Garner had made, that Kofi Annan had talked about, that Donald Rumsfeld had talked about. The first thing he did is he said that he would pick the people who would make up Iraq's governing council. Originally, they were supposed to be elected in a national assembly. That's what Jay Garner had promised. That's what they'd done in Afghanistan, actually. And Bremer said, actually, I'll pick them. I'll pick them myself. And actually, they're just going to be advisors. They're not going to have any power. The next thing he did is he started canceling local elections. The local elections that happened in Mosul, they were rolled back. All these communities that had votes to elect their local councils, something very strange started to happen. They would be visited by an American company called the Research Triangle Institute, RTI. The Research Triangle Institute had been given a contract worth up to $500 million by USAID, and their job was to build local democracy. RTI is based in North Carolina in a research, industrial sort of research park in suburban North Carolina outside Duke. I went there, and I interviewed the head of the Iraq program, who also had never been to Iraq when he redesigned their entire electoral system. And he talked to me about best practices, and he also didn't think he was doing governing. He kept talking about governance and building civil society. Iraqis don't like this word, civil society. They ask, are they saying we're not civilized? Why do we need people to come build civil society? Which is, I think, a very good question. So RTI got this contract. They got the contract before the invasion, actually, which means that the process of building democracy in Iraq was fully embedded in the invasion itself. Their base was inside the Green Zone. This is what gives democracy a bad name. And this is what makes people very suspicious, actually, of the idea of democracy. And it starts to be seen as an imperial project, because in this case, it actually was. And it was really amazing to be in this suburban research park where Iraq's future government was being designed. Because, you know, you imagine, you know, what colonialism looked like in previous eras, you know, and it was sort of grand. There would be these, you know, speeches in British Parliament about the divine right to rule. And now, this is what colonialism looks like, a sort of guys in bad suits in this, you know, research park on a USAID contract, dividing Iraq up into 18 electorates and talking about good governance. So what happened was, is the RTI guys would show up in Hilla or Najaf, and they would say, okay, we're here to build local democracy. We're going to set up a democracy school. We'll teach you all about civil society. And they would be told, they'd come with flow charts, and they'd explain how the whole thing was going to work. And they would be told by the people there that they'd already elected a local government. They'd already elected them. They said, well, you're not ready to have elections yet. You can't elect people. And they would go, well, we already did. These are the people that we chose. And there was, and they would start over, because that was not legitimate. The Washington Post did a very good article on this, and they quoted somebody going, you know, we feel like we're going backwards, which they were. So we started to see the promises broken. Bremer's next move was to cancel the national elections entirely. He flew to Washington. He met with George Bush. This is in early November. The resistance was growing. It was becoming clear and clear that if Iraqis actually elected their own government, it would look nothing like the government that they wanted. And he came back to Iraq, and he announced what was called the November 15th plan. And the November 15th plan was, guess what? I'm choosing the next government. Much like his previous plan, there was a pattern. I'm choosing your next government. I wrote a column at the time called Iraq's Appointocracy, because the plan was for Bremer to appoint people who would then appoint people who would then appoint people to these caucuses who would then appoint leaders to the next interim government. And since Bremer was himself appointed, you know, he was not elected in the United States or Iraq, but was appointed by George W. Bush, who at the time was himself appointed by the Supreme Court, you had this glorious new democratic tradition of the appointocracy. The other part of the appointocracy was that these group of appointees were going to write a constitution for Iraq, and that would govern their first sovereign government. And Bremer, being somewhat of a clever guy, managed to get a clause in that constitution that made it illegal and impossible for anyone to change any of his orders. That's clause 26, that his orders could not be amended, rescinded, or altered in any way. This was during the appointed interim government. The government that I'm talking about is the government of Iyad Alawi, right, that was appointed after the June 30th handover. I know it gets confusing, and it's meant to be so that you all stop paying attention and watch reality TV. He announced his plan. Clearly, Iraqis couldn't be trusted with democracy. He and his advisors would choose the next government, and they'd write the constitution. A little more than a year ago, January 19th, 2004, something amazing happened in Baghdad. 100,000 people took to the streets, and they had a completely peaceful protest. 100,000 people was the largest protest that Iraq had seen in decades. They proved that they were willing to do stuff for democracy. Their chant was, no, no selection, yes, yes, elections. These were called by Sistani. They marched peacefully through the streets. Another 30,000 marched in Baghdad saying the same thing. Yes, yes, elections, no, no, selections. I don't think Anderson Cooper was paying attention that day. These calls were disregarded, and in one of the incredible acts of sensitivity, the CPA, the Coalition Provisional Authority, which Paul Bremer headed, brought in a guy named Noah Feldman to write Iraq's constitution, to be the lead constitutional advisor. Noah Feldman also had never been to Iraq. It also happens that Noah Feldman is Jewish, which made Iraqis a little bit angry that their constitution was being written by him. And even Noah Feldman, he's just written a book called What We Owe Iraq, where he talks about these battles over who was going to write the constitution. And when Sistani came forward and said, you know what, I think we should have elections first and then write the constitution, this is what Noah Feldman wrote. He said that Sistani's conclusions and reasoning were indeed essentially indistinguishable from those of any competent international lawyer. Such views had been privately expressed by international lawyers from a variety of countries experienced in nation building elsewhere, who assumed that the Iraqi constitution would be written only by an elected constituent assembly and were appalled by any suggestion to the contrary. This is their chief constitutional advisor. So maybe it's Paul Bremer who needed to go to democracy school and get a refresher course on what democracy actually means. At the time, we heard all these excuses about why they couldn't have elections to choose the interim government. They said it was too dangerous. The same people now who are just overjoyed because Iraqis had to face 175 attacks in a single day to go to the polls said, at a time when the country was immeasurably calmer, that it was impossible to have elections because of security reasons. Iraq was so safe at that time. I mean, it wasn't safe, but it was safe enough that you could have 100,000 people on the streets having a protest, which is unthinkable now, okay? They said security wasn't ready. And the other thing that they said was, we don't have a census. But of course, they had been asked to do a census at the first meeting of the Baghdad City Council. And in fact, there had been, it's now emerged that there is a census office in Iraq, that they had given them a clear plan for how they could have conducted a census in the time allowed, but they buried it because they didn't want to have the census. It's one of the things that drives me crazy about all the celebration of the blue fingers. The reason why people had to dye their fingers blue is because they never did a census. And now it's, you know, purple power, and it's the symbol of freedom. It's not a symbol of freedom. It's a symbol of total repression of democracy. Because if they'd had the census, they wouldn't have had to dye people's fingers. They would have had a list of eligible voters. They don't need to dye people's fingers to make sure they don't vote twice. That's why I get a little upset for the cheering for the blue fingers. And I also get upset because I wonder, where were all these people who are so excited at the idea of Iraqis wanting to do stuff for their freedom when these demands were being made more than a year ago? So that was point one, this absurd idea that Iraqis were about proving a desire for freedom, which of course existed for anyone who wanted to look. Then there's this other idea, which is that it was about proving a willingness to stand up to terror. And this one gets me a lot, because there's no doubt that Iraqis took their life in their hands when they went to vote on January 30th. But the question is, why was it so treacherous on that day? And I believe that there is very clear evidence that the tremendous violence that now grips Iraq, and I don't mean to say, I want to be really clear here, there would have been an armed resistance no matter what. But at the start of the invasion, at the start of the occupation, the armed resistance was very small. It really was Saddam loyalists and holdouts. It was completely containable. Basically, those pockets of resistance turned into something different, which is what you see in Iraq today, which is, you know, a national popular uprising, an intifada. When I was in Iraq, I really saw up close how you turn pockets of resistance into a national uprising. And I believe that there were two main contributing factors. The first were Paul Bremer's brutal economic reforms. And the second was the systematic denial of democracy and the systematic broken promises, which served a purpose. And the purpose was to make sure that those economic policies survived into a democracy. And that's what fed the violence. There's an Iraqi, well-known Iraqi industrialist named Hussein Kuba from a large trading family, and he calls the Iraqi resistance alternative employment. When Paul Bremer laid off those 400,000 soldiers, he let them keep their guns. He laid them off, let them keep their guns, but denied them the pensions that had been promised them. He created many, many angry young men. But also it was the way in which the occupation itself, the reconstruction itself, was treated as this laboratory for privatization, for free market ideas. You know, the reconstruction of Iraq could have been Iraq's New Deal. It could have been a massive public works project that just employed hundreds of thousands of Iraqis to rebuild their own country, to rebuild their bridges, to rebuild their electrical plants. They'd done it before. They know how to do it. But instead, they decided to teach them, you know, extreme country makeover, sit back, relax, let the experts from Bechtel do it. And they were going to wow them. I mean, I interviewed the guys in charge of the money, and they really thought this was going to be, they used the word gift again. it was going to be a gift. It was just going to be like, wow, you guys have fantastic engineers. That was the idea. And they didn't anticipate that all the Iraqis with PhDs would be a little bit pissed off that all of these plants that were actually built with European technology were just needlessly being rebuilt with American technology, creating far more work. The currencies were different. I mean, the whole thing was a disaster from the start. And then they get into this vicious cycle where they have to spend more and more of their budgets on security. It started off that they were spending 10% of their budgets on mercenary soldiers to protect them from Iraqis, on life insurance. Then it crept up to 30. Then it crept up to 50. The latest estimates are that 60% of the budgets of these American contractors, who already have inflated budgets because they're paying American salaries, are going to their security and their insurance. This is theft. It's theft not, I'm sorry, of U.S. taxpayers. It's theft from the Iraqi people who still have yet to see the reconstruction that they've been promised. And now they're going backwards because the reconstruction is seen as so much a part of the foreign invasion that the reconstruction itself gets targeted. And as soon as something is rebuilt, it gets blown up. That's the vicious cycle. The other issue is that every time the elections were delayed and canceled, every time Paul Bremer appointed instead of elected another council, more and more Iraqis became convinced that this was not a liberation, it was an occupation, and Americans were here to stay. The issue is not, for me, whether Iraqis were brave to risk their lives and go to the polls, because of course they were. But I think we have to ask, that we have a responsibility to ask, how many lives would have been saved if those elections had been held a year ago, before the terror against civilians became so widespread? Imagine if Paul Bremer had had that census. Now, this is the other thing about those purple fingers, is that made Iraqis vulnerable to retaliation, right? I mean, it's one thing to celebrate it, but then you go home to your neighborhood and you're marked. You participated in these elections that many people believe were collaboration with the occupation, and you can't hide it. But the candidates were anonymous, right? I mean, they were voting for candidates whose identity was protected for security reasons. Now, that has to be the first election in history where the voters are marked and the candidates are anonymous. Iraqis stand up to terror every day. They have no choice. It's not defiance. It's just a brutal and totally unjust reality and nothing to cheer about or celebrate. Because regular people in Iraq don't get body armor. Nobody gives it to them. Their homes aren't protected by blast walls. Their neighborhoods aren't patrolled by police or soldiers. And if they are, they're probably more afraid of them than feel secure because of them. They stand up to terror to go to work. They stand up to terror to go to school. They stand up to terror to buy groceries. They stand up to terror to go to a wedding or a funeral. They stand up to terror to go to a mosque. Valium sells like wildfire in Baghdad. They sell it in liquid form on the streets. A staggering number of Iraqis are clearly addicted to Valium because it's the only thing that gets them through the day. So that's why I find it deeply sickening to hear George Bush talk about how proud he is of Iraqis because they stand up to terror, because I know that it's his policies that have actively fed that terror. What feeds violence in Iraq is every time a U.S. tank fires on a mosque, every time a father is tortured in Abu Ghraib, every time a family is killed at a checkpoint because they didn't understand the directions because they were in English. Every time Iraqis see permanent structures being built on U.S. military bases, every time U.S. soldiers move into Saddam's former palaces and won't leave, every time a revered cleric is arrested for criticizing the government, just like during Saddam's time, every time an expat with no base in Iraq, like Chalabi or Alawi, is named as the next leader of Iraq. Another thing that feeds terror is reading in your newspapers, as Iraqis did a couple of weeks ago, that the U.S. occupation had lost $8.8 billion of their oil money, just misplaced it, no record. That also feeds violence. What feeds the violence that terrorized Iraqis on Election Day is the occupation. It's the occupation itself. By refusing and refusing and refusing to end, that is the source of terror in Iraq. and the end to terror in Iraq, the beginning of the end to terror in Iraq, will happen with the end to occupation. I want to talk a little bit more about what Iraqis voted for. The United Iraqi Alliance, which just won 51% of the vote, I want to tell you about a couple things in their electoral platform. This is one of their points. They call for adopting a social security system under which the state guarantees a job for every fit Iraqi. Guarantees a job. They call for a complete write-off of Iraq's debts. They want to cancel all reparations because Iraq is paying reparations to Kuwait, to Saudi Arabia, to the United States, to Britain. Not only is Iraq not being paid reparations, but even under occupation, they're paying out billions in reparations for Saddam's wars. That's how unjust it is. They say that'll be canceled. And they say that they want to use the oil wealth for economic development. A job for every Iraqi guaranteed by the state. Oil wealth used for development. This is starting to sound a little bit more like Hugo Chavez's Venezuela than Paul Bremer's Iraq. And it would be wonderful to believe that now that they voted for these policies, they're actually going to get them. But in fact, this is being treated as irrelevant as the call for withdrawal. And the reason for that is that all of these economic policies, what's been happening during all the delays that didn't happen by accident, is that all these economic policies have been systematically locked in through a variety of means. And I'll just give you a couple of examples because it gets a little bit bureaucratic. But unfortunately, you do have to pay attention to the small print in the middle of a war. And it's when we don't pay attention to the small print that you have incredible betrayals of beautifully brave liberation movements. If you think about South Africa, the people who put their bodies on the line, who died in uprisings to defeat apartheid, in the transition period when they were negotiating the handover from the apartheid rulers to the first African National Congress government, they got them to agree to inherit the debts of the apartheid regime, that the debts that were used to buy weapons to kill their own people would then be paid off by the newly liberated South Africans. And they also, by agreeing to hold on to that debt, they were also locked into a structural adjustment program with the International Monetary Fund, which meant that even though the ANC platform said that freedom does not just mean the freedom to vote, it means the freedom to have a job, to have housing, to have water, to have electricity. It was explicitly for wealth redistribution. That is what the South Africans fought for, died for, and voted for, but it's not what they got. They have the vote and they don't have water. They get their water cut off in the townships. They get evicted from their township housing because their housing complexes are being privatized. This is how liberation movements are sold in the fine print in the transition period. So I urge you, please read the fine print. Read the fine print because it's your governments who are negotiating it. It's our governments. These deals are being made in Washington. They're being made in Geneva. They're not being made in Baghdad because the people signing the deals won't even go to Baghdad anymore because they're so scared. But nonetheless, in the months before the elections, a flurry of deals were signed, most notably a deal between the U.S.-appointed Iraqi government and the Paris Club group of industrialized countries. These are the richest countries in the world, and they hold a huge portion of Iraq's debt. This was reported on as a huge victory for the Iraqi people because it was reported on as the Paris Club agrees to forgive 80% of Iraq's debts. If you read the fine print, what they actually agreed to is this. When you have a debt that is at the level of Iraq's debts, which is $200 billion, which makes it the largest debt load in the world per capita, it's what is called an unsustainable debt. The International Monetary Fund evaluated Iraq's debt, determined that it's unsustainable. What an unsustainable debt means is that it's unpayable. It's structurally unpayable, impossible to pay. When a debt is unpayable, it's more of a problem for the people who are owed the money than the people who owe the money. So what they did is they wrote down enough of the debt to make it payable. Still a huge debt load when you're dealing with that level of debt. And then they locked them into, they staggered it to the year over three periods. We'll forgive some of it now, we'll forgive some of it in 2006, and we'll forgive more of it in 2008, depending on whether Iraq follows an IMF structural adjustment program, which requires the privatization of state-owned companies, and requires that Iraq's food ration program on which 60% of the population, and that's conservative, relies on for basic nutrition, will be eliminated, and people will be given cash instead of food, $15 a month. So that's the plan. That's how you sell out democracy in the transition period. So that joy that we saw in those faces, never have people risked so much for so little, because the democracy that they got was designed to be born still, was designed to be born without power. Now, the good news is all of this is totally illegal. It's totally illegal under international law. It's completely illegal for occupiers under the Geneva Convention, under the Hague Regulations, to sell off the assets of the country they are occupying, and it's illegal for them to rewrite the laws of the country that they are occupying. But they did all of this. There actually is a clear argument that can be made by a sovereign government of Iraq that they don't have to abide by the laws that Paul Bremer wrote. They could tear up that constitution of his, which locked in all of his laws and made it so impossible for them to change, even under the current government. They could just tear it up. They could say this is an illegitimate document because it's never been ratified by the UN, and it wouldn't stand up in any court. They could say that they refused to pay Saddam's debts because they're odious. They're odious debts because they were debts that were money that was knowingly lent to a brutal dictator so that he could wage war on his neighbors and on his own people. These are odious debts. They don't need to negotiate for them to be written down so that they can be paid off. They can just default. That is their right to do under international law. The question is, will they do it? Because if they do it, we'll start hearing all about how these are mad fundamentalists, how they don't really believe in democracy. You know, they gave them the vote, but you can't trust them with the vote. It's an illiberal democracy, which means that we have, I think, our work cut out for us. So I get worried sometimes when I come to the U.S. and I talk to progressive Americans who fought incredibly hard during the elections to defeat Bush. And I hear this incredible despair. And I say to people, did you listen to the State of the Union address? Did you listen to the inaugural address? Did you hear what he said? And they go, I can't listen to him anymore. Listen to him. Listen to him. You cannot leave the language of democracy to George Bush. You cannot leave the language of freedom to George Bush. We have to fight for these words, and we have to make them mean something. And the way to make them mean something in Iraq is to take all of this hot air that is blowing about freedom and democracy and force them to deliver it. Say, here are the prerequisites for freedom. We are listening to the people of Iraq. We're not making it up from here like the guys at the Research Triangle Institute. We are listening to them. They are calling for a freedom from debt, none of their dictators' debts and none of their occupiers' debts. They want full control over their economy and full control over their oil industry. They don't want to pay reparations for Saddam's wars. They want to be paid reparations for these illegal wars. If we can listen to them and we can bring those voices to the places where the decisions are being made, we'll do more than help the people of Iraq. It will stop future wars, because the way to stop future wars is to make war unprofitable. Make war unprofitable. That means denying them the reasons they waged the war, the goals of war, the loot. What was the loot? It was military bases. It was this free market utopia, and they don't have it yet. If we can keep them from winning what they went to war for, maybe they won't go to war again. Thanks.
That was Naomi Klein presenting War and Fleece, Economic Shock Therapy in Iraq. Her talk at UC Santa Cruz on February 16, 2005, was recorded, mixed, and edited by Vinnie Lombardo.